Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. In another of our new Gearing Up episodes, we were honoured to be joined by Willie T. Ribbs, the first African-American racing driver to test a Formula One car and compete in the Indy 500. But throughout his career, faced roadblocks amplified because of the colour of his skin. We chat to Willie about his career, his new Netflix documentary Uppity, his thoughts on new championships like Formula E, as well as modern day issues around race, including the tragic death of George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, and what motorsport is doing to combat its racial divide. A quick warning to you, we do discuss controversial figures such as boxing promoter Don King, as well as characters like Bill Cosby. The Willie T. Ribbs story is an incredible one, and well, I'll shut up now and let you listen to his own words. But once again, thank you so much to you guys who continue to download and listen. If you like it, please do leave us a review. It really helps us to get bigger, and enjoy.
Welcome to the second episode of our new Gearing Up series, where we chat with unsung heroes or people we feel you need to be aware of and who should get your attention. Our regular series continues, and you can go ahead and listen to our interviews with the likes of David Coulthard, Crofty, Sebastian Buemi, Brendan Hartley, Groen Chandhok, Mark Blundell, and many more. First up on Gearing Up, we had Todd McCandless, the biggest F1 podcaster you've probably never heard of, but certainly should. On this show, we've got someone you probably have heard of. But before we introduce him, I have to head east to Essex, home of the second longest coastline of any English county, and also England's smallest town, Manningtree. However, Essex is best known for being home to the illustrious co-host, Harry Benjamin. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Tim. Thank you again for the lovely introduction. I feel like you might have used up all your Essex facts, and I think you're reusing some now. I'm doing all right back in the cupboard, in the recording cupboard in my loft, but doing all right. But you know, you have we got a baby yet?
No, not? Baby yet. I'm still waiting. We keep organizing these podcasts and recordings at different times. This one in the UK where we are now, it's about 8 o'clock in the evening. We've got some more booked in for Wednesday, and due date is what day is it today? Thursday. Due date is tomorrow. The baby's due tomorrow. So or is it Saturday? It's either tomorrow or Saturday, I'm not sure. So any time from now could be a disaster. But anyway, we'll plow on and deal with that situation when it comes. Shall I introduce today's guest?
Absolutely, let's do it.
So, ladies and gents, Willie T. Ribbs is a former American racing driver. He was the first African-American to test a Formula One car and made history when he successfully navigated the month of May to reach one of the most important races in the world, the Indy 500, on a shoestring budget. The Defiance star dominated series, including Trans Am, IMSA and others, and has even competed in the UK, where he showed pace that surpassed drivers who went on to not only compete in, but win in Formula One. It's our pleasure to have him dialing in all the way from the USA. Willie, welcome to the Motormouth podcast.
What's going on, players?
Willie, absolute pleasure and honour to have you on the podcast. Thank you for agreeing to come on. Now, I know we chatted a little bit just off air now, but tell us what lockdown life is like where you are. You're in Texas, aren't you?
Yeah, but I'm, you know, Texas is a big state. And I live out in the country, and I like being out in the country. And we don't have to wear a mask. We don't have to wear clothes out here. Okay? I mean, I walk to the mailbox buck naked, and the squirrels and the deer, you know,
squirrels.
They're checking
one
it
with
out.
Nature.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's nice. So you're not a city boy then. You prefer being out in the sticks.
Oh yeah. I grew up in it on my grandfather's ranch. And, you know, once my racing career came to a slowdown, I'm back on it again.
Yeah, very nice too.
Amazing. Now, of course, we've all seen your documentary that's out on Netflix in the UK and across the globe as well, Uppity. Let's talk about that to begin with. We can see you there with the Uppity cap on as well, doing the and making sure the promo is getting spot on. first of all, brilliant documentary. Anybody who's listening to this hasn't seen it, go and watch it immediately. It is brilliant, emotional, and even if you're not into racing, the story is incredible. How was it for you when did they come to you with this idea? Or was it your idea? How did it all come about?
The producer, Adam Carolla, he had initially did a film on Paul Newman. It was called The Racing Life of Paul Newman. And this was 5 years ago. And he interviewed me. They came to the ranch. They interviewed me about my relationship with Newman. He was very important in my career. Almost... one of the most important. And after the film was done, he called me back and he says, I'm getting a lot of response to your interviews and we would like to do a story on you. I said, on one condition, that we don't pull any punches. I said, it's going to be the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's going to be some people that are butthurt. But as my grandpa used to say, that's why you got a butt. Go get it hurt sometime.
Yeah, I think you do. It does an amazing job as well at telling your story. Because I suppose, was there always a bit of a fear that, it might not convey what you wanted to? You were pretty happy with the outcome of it all.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. And I'm going to tell you, when I went to the editing room, when it was done right before Adam Carolla's Christmas party. And my wife and I flew down to L.A., to Hollywood. He took us, and they had this party at his studio. So he took us into his screening room, and he says, I'm going to put you two in here. Here's the couch. I'm closing the door. No one's coming in. And when it was done, I was prepared to be disappointed. I was. And when it was over, people thought, my wife and I had an argument because she came out of the room crying and she was, it was hard to imagine that they could create, because there was material in there that I didn't know existed. Wow. And how they put the narratives together, the storyline, and the interviews, including the king himself, Bernie Ecclestone, it was just brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. All of it.
And there was it's a very highly charged and an emotional show. It must have been, in a way, I guess, therapeutic for you to talk it through like that in such depth. And there are moments in the documentary where you do get emotional and there are people close to you that you've lost over the years. And that feeling of loss comes across really well. What was it like reliving all this stuff and going back over your memories?
You'd be surprised how much you can remember without being waterboarded. It all starts to come back. And, with some visuals, which I had in front of me, to be able to tell the story, to recollect. And it was the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, it was... that was the film. And I, the emotional parts, they, it was almost opening up a little wound that was there.
Yeah. And how's the response been from those that have featured in the documentary? Have you heard from people that you haven't heard from many years with their thoughts of support or negative responses even?
Yeah, it's been, the response worldwide has been phenomenal. And the individuals that were in it, they told a story, and they had the cojones, you know. I don't know what that means, how they interpret that in England.
We got you. Yeah, that works.
Same way, okay. Yeah. They told it like it was. And they didn't bite their lip. And that's what gave impact to it. They knew what was going on, and they told it like it was, and they were happy.
Amazing. Well, it really is a brilliant documentary, and I'm sure we will come back in and talk about it throughout the show. But let's talk about the very beginning for you, and you know, growing up and that passion for racing cars. When did that first happen? You know, when did the racing bug bite you, and you go, "Yep, I know, I want to be a motor racing driver."
Well, I mean, I was going to the races with my dad at 3 years old because my dad was actually racing. When I was born, he had started on motorcycles. He was racing dirt track. And his buddy who he grew up with by the name of Joe Leonard was a national motorcycle champion. But then eventually Joe Leonard went on to race cars. And then my dad was getting on in age, you know, but, you know, after you're about 25, 26 years old, it's time to get off those two wheels and get on four, right? Because, yeah, the rash, you know, all that rash all over your body. Yeah.
So not pleasant.
Yeah. So he went on to cars, and I was traveling to the races with him at a very early age. And I knew at 9 years old what my goal was. I knew this is what I want to do. I didn't want to work in the family business because I had an option. I mean, I didn't have to go to school even. I mean, I could have just quit school and worked in the family business. I didn't want to do that. I mean, especially working for my dad. I know I could work for my grandpa, but I couldn't work for my dad. And so I got my racing license, you know, when I got out of high school, and I headed for England. And I knew, and I followed all the, my dad's friends were all race drivers, which included Dan Gurney and Phil Hill. He knew all the drivers that were legends at that time. So my career path, mainly, I came to England because Emerson Fittipaldi did. I knew that he left Brazil for a reason, and I read his story. He came to England because he wanted to be in Formula One, and that was the reason I wanted to go to England.
And when
Formula One.
When you came over to our shores, and you're still relatively young at this stage, what was going through your head? Did it feel like a massive move? When, where did you live? What did you do? How did you, you know, make money? Did you get immersed in the culture here? What was it like?
It was like going to another planet. I mean, I tell people when I left the United States, I'd never been to England. I lived in Harold Wood, Essex.
Oh, hey. Harry's part of the world. Yeah.
Right. It was sort of a spinoff from Harold Hill. It was like a suburb of a place called Harold Hill. And Harold Wood was a really nice place. It was close to the train station there, so I could go in and out of London. And I was learning my way around Harold Wood, and after a while, you know, the neighborhood knew there was a Yank in town, and he was colored. And so you know, I used to go to a pub called Spencer's Arms there, which was walking distance from my. I lived in a one room flat. One room. That's all I had the money for. And my parents were sending me money to race for a team called Scorpion Racing. And it was owned by a gentleman named Mike Eastick. And Scorpion brought a lot of drivers along. I mean, they were quite well known for bringing up drivers. And I went out to his farm near Snetterton. That's where his farm was near. And I told him I wanted to drive, rent his race car. And when I first got to his ranch, he thought I was there to work on the farm. And I said, well, you know, I'm not a farm worker. I came here to drive cars. And so he put me in a test, and we did a test at Snetterton. And then first race was Mallory Park. I finished third. The second race was Snetterton, and I won. And I knew right then I think I could get the job done.
Yeah, because it's the UK scene at F4, F3 level is still hugely competitive. If you can win at that level in the UK, you know you've got something. Have you been back to Snetterton and those tracks since? Have you come back over here?
I'm there every other year.
Great.
In England. And the reason I'm there is my son, Theo, is one of the top clay shooters in the world. So he comes to High Wycombe.
Yep.
Every year. And competes at E.J. Churchill shooting grounds. And I found out when I, you know, and I know everyone at E.J. Churchill, found out that Bernie Ecclestone's wife shoots there.
Small world.
Bernie's wife is a clay shooter. She shoots at E.J. Churchill. Ross Braun, who's a good friend of mine, shoots at E.J. Churchill. So, yeah, I'm in England, and it's great because I get to come back and see Akram Sami, who has been at McLaren. Akram Sami was my partying buddy when I lived in England. This was 1977, 79.
Wow. That's so cool. Yeah. So Akram is, he's a legend on the commercial side of motorsport. I mean, you know, he's up there. He's as good as it gets.
Oh, yeah. No, we were both young then. And even then, Sami was, I mean, he could sell ice to Eskimos. I mean, he just had that look and still does.
Yeah.
He still does. He could do his own talk show.
God, that's amazing. I didn't realize you came over so much. That's brilliant. Well, that's good news because we must meet up and we can take you for a beer down our local pub. We'll take you back to Essex.
Back to Essex.
Oh yeah, no, I'd love to get back and go to the pub again. And walk in there. I mean, I had two or three fist fights in there when I lived there. They thought I was Jamaican.
Yeah, but you're
in there, man. Yeah, but, yeah. I walked in there one day at a New Year's party, and then, what are you doing? I said,
Yeah, but Willie, you're quite handy with your fists, aren't you? You can hold your own.
It's funny, you know, and I said, what the hell is that? And so the guy told me, I said, well, we use the N-word back in the United States.
He's got me on boxing now. This is game over. Do you follow the heavyweight boxing scene now?
A little bit. You know, I got a lot of friends in the industry. You know, Ali was my mentor,
yeah.
And everyone, the whole world knows about Muhammad Ali and my relationship. And, you know, me going to Brixton with him one day. And Ray Leonard and I are very good friends. Sugar Ray.
Yeah.
Mike Tyson. Mike took me to a party one night in Cleveland. That was crazy. So, I mean, the boxing stories. And I trained with Leonard. I trained with Larry Holmes. I trained with Ray Mercer, John the Beast Mugabe. And they were all like, teach us how to drive our fast cars and we'll teach you some boxing.
It's so cool.
Did Muhammad Ali, what's, you know, he must have given you so many, he must have said so many things. Was he there giving you advice as well? Is there anything that stuck with you over the years?
No, more just, you know, you gotta be a man. Don't ever let him see you cry. He was very hard about be it not showing weakness. And that was invaluable.
Yeah.
He said, because, you know, he knew what the oppositions I was going to deal with. He knew it. He came from Louisville, Kentucky. That's the Confederacy down there.
Yeah, yeah. And you adopted his shuffle, of course, when you you'd get your victory, go on top of your car and do the Ali shuffle.
Well, I want to see Lewis do it. I know that Formula One nose a little narrow, but I want to see Lewis. You know, he gets he up on the car, right? All right, but I want you to get them shoes. So they'll slide easy on that nose.
It's a bit dangerous. There's not as much surface area to do that on. One false move and he's off.
Oh, yeah. No, you better be good, Frank Sinatra.
Oh, dear. Who were you competing against in the UK? What were some of the names that you were racing against and beating?
I raced Formula Ford.
Okay.
In the Formula Ford Championship. Now, that's where Nigel Mansell and I, in my fourth race, I think it was, the race that Bernie Ecclestone and Gordon Murray came, they actually came to see me.
Oh, right.
They came out. I was stunned. And they walked. I was walking down the pit lane, and they walked up to me, and they said, I'm Bernie. I said, yes, sir, I know Mr. Ecclestone who you are. And I knew Gordon. And so they said to me, we've been watching you and keep up the good work. And I just thought, that's it. My reasoning for coming to England was just answered, right? And that same race, Nigel was there racing. Well, I didn't meet Nigel Mansell until we were on the lorry going around the racetrack with a victory wreath on our neck. The race was over. Michael Rowe won it from Ireland. I was second. Nigel was third. And we got up on the podium. We shook hands. And then we got down, walked down the steps. This was at Brands Hatch. We got in the lorry on the back of it where you could stand up and go around the track and wave to the crowd like the queen, you know, how you move your hand like that.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how to do that, right? Then I'm watching the, you know, Nigel, you know, he could do it pretty damn good, right? You know, so on that lorry is where Nigel and I formally introduced ourselves and started talking. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And Mansell, then as now, was a bad cat. Oh, he was a bad cat. I mean, him and I went at it, right? And we both could see each other's numbers a lot because that's how sideways we were. I mean, we were going through the first corner. I forget the name of that corner. At Brands Hatch,
yep.
You go over the hill.
Down to the right.
We could look to the side and see each other's numbers. That's how cross we were.
So what were your next steps? You're racing in Formula Ford. You're beating the likes of Nigel Mansell. You've got Bernie Ecclestone saying, hi, we can see you. We like what we're seeing. Keep it up. What are you thinking? And what's next? What happens next? Because you only got so far in the UK before having to go back to America.
I ran out of money. And my parents, you know, were paying the bills. And they said, well, you know, we got, you got some sisters and brothers we got to put through college. And so, you know, they are watching how much money we're giving you. So you're going to have to
come home. They're
not happy. Yeah, you're going to have to come home. You know, I know you think you're the golden boy, but you're going to have to saddle up that horse and get back to the United States. So I came home and I got an opportunity to do some open Formula Atlantic races in the United States in the early 80s. It was actually my first race was 1978. And then I went back to Long Beach in 1982. And 82, when I qualified on the pole, there was a big deal. That's when, you know, and there were some great drivers in that race. Jeff Brabham, Alan Sir Jr., Roberto Moreno, Michael Andretti, there were some real young, tough cats. And then right, I was leading a race and we had an engine failure. But the message was sent, and then I got a phone call from Paul Newman later on that year to put me in a Trans Am car, and which made me a paid race driver.
And that transition from single seat to single formula, single seat to cars into these huge Trans Am cars, big bag cars, big tires, very powerful. How did you cope with that transition? Did it just come to you?
The best parallel I can use, it's like dancing with a woman, a slow dance, right? Who's like Twiggy, and then dancing with, Oprah.
Oh, example. Yeah.
Yeah, bigger, right?
Bigger.
More full.
Yeah, because she's not that big anymore. So you've got to go kind of, sturdier.
Roseanne Barr,
There you go.
I mean, we got some girth there.
Yeah, girth, that's the word.
We got some girth. Well, that's the woman, Twiggy. I mean, you can move her around real easy.
Yeah, nimble.
Big girl.
I never thought we'd ever get Twiggy and Oprah in the same sentence on this podcast.
It works.
Thought that would ever come up.
It works.
There you go.
You're just a different way you deal with the car. that's all. But I've seen great drivers over the years, and Mario Andretti is one of them. Bobby Unser is another one. Jim Clark. Those guys could jump into any car and go fast, whether it was on the dirt, whether it was a stock car, whether it was a Formula One, whether it was an Indy car. Their versatility was what I wanted to be able to do. And it didn't take long for me to adapt to a car that was over twice as heavy as an open wheel car.
Big old beasts. Yeah. Big old beasts. Mm. And you were up against David Hobbs at this stage. Mm. And that was quite a, how do we put it, tasty relationship that you had together.
Good old David. I mean, I sort of feel for him because, he was told he was going to be the big man on campus, right? He was lead sled dog. Well, you know what they say about sled dogs. Everything behind that lead sled dog, they all look the same, right? I wasn't prepared to be number two, and I was fast, and I was faster than David. And I don't think David expected that, nor the team. And especially me transitioning from a Formula Atlantic car, which is rear engine and less than 1,000 pounds, to a front engine car with big tires that had 700 horsepower, that weighed 2,800 pounds. They didn't expect that.
And why then was that favoritism there? Was it because of the color of your skin you were not favored?
No, I wouldn't say that as much as Hobbs's name.
Right.
Hobbs was a renowned race driver, right? From Formula One, from sports car. I mean, he had a big name, and they were hiring him for his big name. And I was to be the junior, I was to be the new kid who was going to be groomed. Well, actually I was doing the grooming.
Yeah.
All right. And that was hard. That was some tough steak and kidney to swallow.
And you got rookie of the year, right? That year?
Yeah. In fact, I won more races. He won 4 races and I won 5. I just happened to have some mechanical failures.
Yeah, you've had some bad luck with engines, I think it's fair to say, and we'll come on to that more later with your Indy 500 exploits. So just skipping forward a little bit, 1984-ish, you move across to Corvette. Tell us a bit about that period. And I think we're creeping towards the time that you met a certain Don King.
Well, in 84, I raced for Dietley in 1983, was Rookie of the Year in Trans Am. Budweiser Camaros. At the end of the year, after Las Vegas, we sat down the next day. They said, Chevrolet wants us to go to Corvette, and we're going to the Corvette platform, and it's going to be different. Geometry is going to be different, all this. And so I said, no problem. And I said, am I going to be number two to Hobbs? They said, no. I said, okay, with a level playing field, right? Right. All right. So we go to the first race. I think I had qualified on the front row. I was a second, and there was a guy I got into altercation with. I think he might have been on the pole. Hobbs was, I think, third. Anyway, in warm-up, Sunday morning warm-up, I come out of the pits, and as I come out of the pits, the guy I had an altercation with, who was on the pole, goes by me, boom, right, and disappears. Well, halfway around the track, he's going very slow, like waiting for me slow, right? So we get up, and I pull next to him, and we get onto the back straight, and he drag races me down the back straight at Road Atlanta. And that's a long back straight, and you drop downhill into a 180 mile per hour dog leg, and he sort of eased me off, right? Eased me off into the grass. And so I followed him into the pits, and I got out of the car and I ran down to talk with him.
To maybe do something else?
I wanted to tap him on the helmet first, just so I could get his attention. And I tapped him, you know, I gave him the old head slap. And when I got back to my pit, the team manager, who did not like me, fired me.
Right then and there?
Right then. As I was talking to him, they were covering my car up. He says, you're gone. So, and I knew they wanted to get rid of me.
So this was the excuse.
Yeah, that was their out. A rumor was put out that I intentionally got fired, that so Ford could hire me. That I set the whole thing up. Me and Ford. Right. It was a conspiracy. And I was getting calls from the media. Word is, wow. Word has it that you got intentionally fired so Ford could hire you. And a deal was already done before the first punch.
Well done, you.
So you've got this, you're with Ford and it's going great and that kind of thing. Let's talk about, we've touched on it briefly, Don King. He's, absolute legend, of course, for people who are somehow not familiar, of course, a massive promoter in the boxing world. Let's talk about how that relationship started and I suppose the early beginnings of the road to the Indy 500.
Well, and I'll get into this, the amazing story, the meeting between Don King and Bernie Ecclestone was a movie that was a movie in itself. It was 1984, last race of the year, Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas. And that race was in conjunction with, I think, IndyCar at the time. Formula One had just left because Formula One had been there prior.
Yeah.
So the race is over. I get out of the car. Well, there's not many black guys running around the pits, right? Not in a suit, right? So I'm pulling off my helmet and I'm talking to the team. And as I'm walking away back to my pit, this guy comes up to me and he says, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. And I work for Don King. And he would like to meet you." I said, "When?" "He's tonight."
Okay.
So he's at the Riviera. And he would like you to, he had a fight going on. I think it was Bone Crusher Smith and Larry Holmes, I think it was. And so I said, "I'll be there." He said, "Come to his office. He'd like to see his office at about 6 o'clock. So I went back to my room, got changed, went into the office. And I walked into his office and he's rocking back on the chair like this, right? With that, and his hair was up in the air. And he had a cigar and he was smoking a cigar. And he had, you know, his colleagues around him and ushers. And I walk in, he, "Willie D." That's how I talk. "Willie D, Willie D. Sit down. Be the Muhammad Ali of racing." And so he went right into it. And he said he wanted to represent me. And he says, he said, "What do you want to do?" And so I told him I wanted to be F1. I wanted to be in Formula One, if not Indy 500. So he said, "Great." I spent maybe half an hour with him. He said, "Here's the ticket to the fight." He said, "You got a girlfriend with you?" I said, "Well, my wife's here." He says, "Well, here's two tickets to the fight." So I did that and then went to the fight, went to the after party and all that. And then we started getting in contract with each other. And that was the craziest contract negotiation ever. Mm. It was, I see how he could get fighters to sign. Because most of these guys were so, they couldn't read, you know, and that's not their fault. You know, they were fighters. You know, they started fighting early. They didn't understand anything. Well, I did. I come from a business family. So, you know, after we, you know, went back and forth for months, nearly almost 2 months, we finally got the contract looking pretty decent. And, you know, we got it signed. And, but his lawyer was dead set against it. His lawyer did not like, because Don ended up saying, we went back and forth so many times. Don said, "Okay, you guys write the contract the way you want to write." And so we wrote it. It was fair. And Don's lawyer looked at this and went to a certain page. He went to a particular page. He said, "Fuck these niggas, Don." And I thought, and he threw the contract on the floor. And my attorney is very pale and very redheaded. So I looked over at him and I said, "You ever been called a nigger?"
But that went down well.
And so he was like red-faced, right? Yeah. So anyway, we got through. I said to Don, I said, "Look, this is it. I'm going to sign it. This contract. We're not going to go. You know, we've done this. We've done all the talking we're going to do." And so he said, "All right." I said, "Well, no guts, no glory, Don." I said, you got everything to gain. And so we started, and that was it.
Yeah.
He did a hell of a job. I mean, Don could snap his fingers and get money.
Yep.
And he was brilliant. I only know one other guy can do that, and that's Bernie.
It's Bernie, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And Don did the job for you. He got you essentially to the Indy 500. And just skipping ahead to that, whether it was too early, not the right time, not the right money, not the right preparation, a rushed project, poor relationship with the team mechanic, a dangerous car, you decided, "I can't do this. I'm not going to race." And then the press really went for it.
I had gotten, yeah, I, I knew, and it wasn't Don's fault.
No.
Don didn't know. All Don knew how to do was get money, right? He got the money. But the crew chief there was, in my opinion, a card-carrying member. And when you say card-carrying member in America, that means one thing. KKK, right?
Wow.
It's a metaphor. He might not be KKK. However, he made it clear that I wasn't the driver he wanted, right? Even though he was getting paid to do it.
But how did that sit with you? Were you just like, right, I'm here, I'm just going to get on with it? Or how do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, Indy is a racetrack you do not play games with. Okay? Indy will kill you. And a lot of drivers have died there. Indy, with exception of the Isle of Man, is the most dangerous racetrack on the planet. Isle of Man is numeral.
That's crazy.
Okay? And Indy's right behind that. It's second. And you have to have the right people with you. Okay? Maybe you don't die there, but you can ruin your career there. And so I it wasn't the right group, and I was advised to step away from it, and I did. I did. And I had no second thoughts about doing it. But you've got to, when you go there, you've got to not only do a lot of testing, which I didn't do. I did no testing. You've got to have somebody that you can communicate with. And who can, especially with me being a rookie there, new, it's a tough place.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of drivers that have come there from all over the world and said, this place is, look at Alonso, for example.
Yeah.
Okay. Alonso's a great example. He's world champion. Now, he got in the show the first time. The second time, Alonso... It was a rough ride.
Yeah, it was. It was probably, with hindsight, I mean, it's the right thing to do with all those things against you. The stars not aligning. You know, walk away, fine. And I don't want to give everything away from the documentary. I want people to go and watch it. So I'm going to skip forward a little bit through 1985, where you've gone back to Trans Am with Wally, who features heavily in the documentary and seems like a good all-round guy. And then when the season was over, it was planned that you would test an F1 car. And you would go to Portugal again with Bernie, hooking up with Bernie again. Tell us what it was like when you first experienced a Formula One car, and how different was it from what you'd driven before?
At the end of the year, Don King calls me. This is the middle of the season. This is the Detroit Grand Prix 1985. I get a call from Don. Don says, I want to meet Bernie Ecclestone. I said, okay. I said, he'll be in Detroit. He says, okay, would you ask Bernie if I could meet him at his hotel in Detroit? I said, I will. So I called the big man and said, Don King wants to meet you. He says, no problem with him. And so Bernie got over here for the Grand Prix. Don flies in from New York. I'm literally in a driver's suit. I picked Don up at the airport in Detroit in my driver's suit because I'm supposed to be practicing that day, right? So, and I had a session to do. So I pick him up. We drive back to the hotel in Detroit at the Renaissance Center. I park the car right out on the curb and tell the valet, you got to take this car. I said, I don't have time to park it. So we walk into the hotel. And as we're walking towards the elevator to go up to Bernie's room, Don stops at an ice cream parlor. Okay, now we're on, you know, Bernie's waiting for us, right? I'm looking at the watch. Okay, come on, let's, you know, what are we the hell we're doing, right? So Don gets two scoops of ice cream, right? He's in a suit and tie, right? Eating this ice cream, and as we get into the elevator, we go up to Bernie's room. We knock on the door, and Bernie answers the door. And Bernie's not Shaquille O'Neal.
Okay? I know.
Bernie's, yeah. Okay.
He's more like a borrower.
Don King is 6'4". So we walk in and Bernie's looking up at Don and Don's licking this ice cream. So we go in and literally the first word, there was no introduction. Bernie says, they haven't even sat down. As Don's walking to sit down, Bernie says, Don, he says, well, what kind of money are you making in that boxing business? It was classic. It was classic. And so Don sort of paused and said, about this much million. How much are you making? And so Bernie says, well, I don't know if we're getting that kind of numbers. They went right into talking money. It was just, how many kids do you have? Are you married?
How many dollars you got?
You know, yeah, right. So they sat down and talked about each other's business for a second. And then Bernie looks at Don and says, Don, what are we going to do with our boy Willie here? And so Don says, well, I want him to race Formula One and I'd like him to be a world champion. So Bernie says, okay. He says, it's going to take funding for that. And when they got there, I said, okay. I looked at my watch. I had to go get in the race car. I had to go qualify. So I left the room and the dialogue was getting heavy. It was getting, it was Clydesdale. You know what a Clydesdale is, right? It's a big horse,
yeah.
Right?
Oh.
Yeah. Well, they were getting real.
Wow.
Serious. So I came back about, an hour and a half later. They were done with the meeting. I knocked on the door. Bernie shakes Don's hand, walks out. And so we get in the elevator, and it's just me and Don. And Don looked at me, and I've never heard Don say this about any man ever, anybody. So we're going down there, but he says, you're a man, Ecclestone. He's a real smart guy. I never heard Don King say anybody was smarter than himself. He looked like he went to class. That's what Don looked when he came out of that room with Ecclestone. It was just and Bernie, he's my uncle. I've always called him Uncle Bernie. I'll go to fist cuffs with anybody for him, and he knows that. And I'm sorry to see he's not running Formula One. It just doesn't seem like it. It's got the same magic.
Bernie, of course, was the man to put you in a Formula One car, and you tested that Formula One car. So, what was it like to pull out in a pit lane in a Formula One car compared to everything else you'd ever driven before? It must have been so amazing.
It was, and Herbie Blash and I have been friends forever. I knew Herbie, and Herbie was running it, right? Bernie wasn't there. Herbie Blash was there. Charlie Whiting was there. I knew them both. So it was from my Formula Ford days. So it was, it was no introduction needed in that department. Before I got in the car, Nelson Piquet comes to me, and he said, really, so I want to talk to you. And it's a Brazilian act. I want to talk to you. So we go around the back of the garage. He says, it's very difficult. So engine, it's a lot of power. It's no in-between. It's the on and off. He was being very animated. It was great. He says, it's a four-cylinder. It's like like some women, they're very hot and cold. He says... And typical Nelson, right? And so he says, just be careful. He says, feel it and understand the power. And he says, this, because he had just went to Williams. He had just left Brabham, and he was going to Williams team with Mansell, I think. And when I got in the car, I rolled out, and it was, the thing was sort of, one thing I learned that the faster you go with that thing, the smoother it got. You had to get through that harsh barrier, you know, get those tires warm and get the chassis to work, get the aerodynamic side of it, get that thing to set down, right? Mm. But the hardest thing to adapt to is how well it stopped. Mm. I could not believe anything could stop like that. And so, after my first run, I got out of the car and I went to lunch. Well, I got back and Patrese was testing as well, and so was DeAngelis, right? And so I'm watching, drove my road car down to turn one. So I had to find out. I said, where do you put the brakes on around here? So I went out on the road car and I thought, holy shit, these cats are getting right to the corner, literally, and putting on the brakes. So I thought, okay, all right, well, so I went around different parts of the track to see what they were doing. So then I started working up to it. And when it was over, I went faster than they had planned on.
Yeah.
No, it's over a second faster.
You clearly impressed. And then obviously you didn't end up in Formula One. The line that was spun was that they wanted an Italian driver. So off you went again, back to the States.
And I wasn't upset. I knew Bernie, he had to have it funded. And I didn't come in with any funding from America or any other multinational country. But I wasn't upset. And I knew Bernie, if he could have done it, he would have.
And it's nice that you've kept that relationship with Bernie. So obviously, you know, one of the good guys. Skipping forward then into the NASCAR days, Deep South, redneck territory, redneck sport. Tough time, I think it's fair to say.
They weren't ready for Willie T. Ribbs down there. And in the South, most African Americans down there were conditioned to stay in their place. You don't speak up. You look down. You don't look eye to eye, and you definitely don't say nothing. All right. Well, I didn't come from there. First of all, I didn't come from a poor or I didn't come from a background where I was a poverty background.
No, okay. And you didn't have a history of saying nothing.
Right, exactly. Right. I didn't come from poverty, and unfortunately, most African Americans there come from poverty. Right. Very, and I didn't. As a matter of fact, one mechanic. I think it was Junie Dunleavy. He's an old owner and mechanic. He was 75 years old. He says to me when I got down there, he says, "Willie, you know, you got to remember that most of these drivers here and mechanics and team owners, they never been around any colored folks in their life." And I said, "Yeah, I understand how they feel, because nor was I." And he just stared at me. I said, "I grew up in San Jose, California, 0.2%. Black or people of color, 0.2%. And I was the only black kid in my class all through my grade year, the only one. So what was I to do? How was I only know one place. When I was down there, there was some words said. No, you know, I mean, the first thing I noticed is that guys were spitting around me, spitting.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. And they knew my reputation as a fighter. So I didn't get, not one of them used the N-word to my face. I just had to walk around spit. And there was, some of the fans were pretty nasty.
Well, the thing that is worrying now is that, you know, if you look at NASCAR today and the news just out that they're finally banning the Confederate state flag, and that has been met with a lot of criticism as well on social media through huge NASCAR fans. So there is still that level of you know, discrimination there. How do you look at, you know, NASCAR in particular is quite a well-known Southern American sport as well. How do you look at it now compared to what you were dealing with then?
Not much has changed.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you why. First of all, if George Floyd hadn't been murdered and he was still alive today, would those flags come down? Those flags would still be up. No one would have ever mentioned it.
Mm.
So that was being reactive, not proactive. Those flags should have been down 30 years ago. Okay. And I dared a lot of people, and I challenged NASCAR and some of its peers. If you're so strong about your beliefs in the First Amendment, then hang up the swastika, put that out in the infield and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Yeah. You believe in the First Amendment? Okay. Fly the Nazi flag in the infield and see how that'll go.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know. They would never do that. Never. So it's come down, but as my grandpa used to say, when a man takes off his shirt, he's still the same man. What's got to change is their heart. Not whether they take a flag down. And right now, there's a lot of upset fans. I'm reading about it right now. They're mad. They're going to boycott NASCAR because their Confederate flag they can't fly their Confederate flag. So what really?
Yeah, well, they can't go to any of the races anyway at the moment. So there's nothing to be bought.
Well, good. I mean, it just shows, though, doesn't it, that, you know, like you say, Willie, has anything really changed? And it does. You know, when you put it like that, it does feel like very much a reactive process rather than proactive, as you say. And we'll touch on this a little bit more, I'm sure, a little later. I want to skip over a few years. We'll let people again see the documentary to catch up on the mid to late 80s. I want to skip forward towards your second go at Indy, and we're heading towards the 90s now. Derek Walker comes around. You have a bit of budget. You can get yourself into the month of May. Tell us about this month of May and the experience leading up to qualifying for the Indy 500, and then that incredible moment, which it really got me in the documentary, when you're driving down the pit lane, you've made it through, and it's that real, you're cheering and everyone's going, yes, this is amazing. And that was the moment in the documentary that made me go, oh, sweet Jesus, I can't take this anymore. Talk us through that month of May.
In the film, when people see the film, every year was something. So it's going to blow their mind.
It's extraordinary.
But, yeah. So, I get a call from Bill Cosby, just like I got a call from Paul Newman. And he says, what do you want to do? And so I told him what I wanted to do. So 91, Derek Walker, the Porsche IndyCar team was over. Porsche was pulling out of IndyCar. Derek had actually left Penske Racing. He was running Roger Penske's team when Rick Mears was there and Bobby Unser and Porsche hired him. Well, Porsche only stayed on for a few years, and then they pulled the plug. So Derek was without a gig. So I found that out. I called Bill, and I said, hey, there's a guy named Derek Walker, and he's a badass, and he could do the job for us. So he said, get him. That's all Bill said, get him. Bye. He would say, get him, bye. And then hang up, right? And so I met Derek Walker at Sebring in February. Daytona, the Daytona 24-hour, mm-hmm. February of 1991. And I said, I'd like to discuss doing Indy 500. Bill Cosby will support it. And he wants us, meaning you and I, to fly to Las Vegas in 2 days to meet him. Just like that. And Walker just sort of stared at me like a deer in headlights, like, is this real? I mean, because I walked right up to him, and we already knew each other. And I told him, I said, Bill is going to do this, and he wants us in Vegas in 2 days. And so Walker said, okay. So we met in Vegas. We went to the Bill. Bill was doing a show, I think, at the Vegas Hilton, I think, at the time. And we got to his dressing room right after his last show, which was, about midnight. And we sit in the dressing room, and Bill instantly liked Derek. And so this is what I'm going to do. Okay. All right. Well, then tell me, do you think we could do a bunch of chain of repair shops, too? And you know, Bill went right. He already, how much is it going to cost? Okay, no problem. And I'll get you the money next week. Literally 2 days after, and we didn't leave his dressing room till 3 a.m. We were in his dressing room through 3. We shook hands, and Cosby said, don't talk to anybody but me. I don't want you to talk to my lawyer, my agent, anything. I'm going to send you the money from my bank account. How many people do that? They don't.
No.
Okay? Nobody does that. So I don't think Derek believed him. I get a call on Tuesday. This show was Sunday night. I get a call on Tuesday, and it's Walker on the phone. And he says, I have the money. I said, yeah, I know. That's what he said he was going to do. He said, no one does that. He said, no one sends the money in 2 days. He says, usually they get around to sending it. He said, I've never dealt with it. Cosby, despite what's happened,
yeah,
he was the most honest man. When he said he was going to do something, he did it. And he did it right then. And usually more. So we got the money. We go to Indy. We had a car that was an old year-old car, and we had to, you know, dust it off and get it right. And Tim Wardrop from England was my engineer. And I owe Cosby and Wardrop everything that happened in 91 and that put me in the Indy 500. Wardrop was just, he reminded me of Ringo Starr, the Beatles. Actually, he's a little bit more attractive. But he had, he always wore those Ringo Starr glasses, right? Yeah. And he had, sometimes he'd be smoking a cigarette, and he was very calm, William. And he had already won Indy as an engineer 2 times. And with Ari Leyendyke. So it was just the best. And we didn't have much. I mean, we were blowing up engines because Buick had a bunch of, for my engine, they had some bad rod bolts, and they were snapping. And finally, we got a good engine with a little pressure on Buick to qualify with. But Wardrop was just, he was so smart, and he was just easy to work with. It was him and Bill and John Waters and Lori Gerrish. There were some great guys. There was only a handful of us, but they were all super talented.
Yeah, yeah. And a big underdog story, because you know you were despite the money that you got from Bill, you were still on a shoestring budget. I mean, this was what, $350,000, which I think they say in the documentary that you spend that before you even turn up at the track. So to qualify, it makes it even more incredible that you got through that qualified on such a shoestring budget in a one-year-old car with a skeleton team. It must have been an unreal feeling when you pulled into that pit lane.
Well, I mean, it wasn't even a shoestring. I mean, this was a thread. and it was, that would, it, that made it real satisfying. That made, you know, to, you know, if you go there in Roger Penske's team, all right, well, there's no, a whole lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You got everything on top of everything, right? To do it. And then in those days, to qualify for the Indy 500, there's 75 guys showing up for 33 spots. It was real hard. It was hard. And when it was over, because you're there for a month, and when you're done, it changes you, because you really see, you really get a chance to look inside yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Willie, it would be amiss of us not to get your take on modern day motorsport. Do you still watch Formula One? Are you a fan?
Because I'm a friend of Lewis's, first of all. I'm his supporter. I support him. I support the stand that he's taken right now.
Yeah.
And it's from a human rights position. There's not many men that do that, especially at the highest level. Why? Because they're worrying about money, what they'll lose, the commercial side of their career. And I was the same way. That's not what it's about. We're human beings. And I watch Formula One because of him. And his dad and I, Anthony, are good friends. I'm his guest when I come to when he comes to Texas every year for the United States Grand Prix. And he's just a good kid. Okay. And he's not a kid. He's a man. But he's old enough to be my son, all right? So, or young enough to be my son. So, I support him, and I got his back. And he's doing the right thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. And he even called out the other F1 racing drivers actively on his socials, saying, "You're not speaking up. I can see you. I'm the only one that's talking here. I'm the only person of color in the Formula One field. I shouldn't be on my own talking about this." And thankfully, others did speak up. But then again, to hark back to what we were talking about with NASCAR and the Confederate flag, it very much seems like
reactive.
It's responsive and a PR spin, and not very much you know something proactive.
Lewis created all of that.
Yeah.
It went from Lewis to the other Grand Prix drivers to NASCAR. They all watched Lewis. So they all jumped on Lewis's bandwagon. Mm-hmm. It started with Lewis, and then it went to NASCAR. So I'm there. Lewis gets the credit for that. And he's taken a lot of heat over it. But Bernie supports him. Right.
Ross Brawn has come out and actually said Formula One is fully behind him as well.
I love Ross Brawn. I've known him forever. And there's a few men that I'll go to blows for in a pub. Ross Brawn's one.
Mm. But I suppose the question is, it is great that all this is happening, that, you know, changes are being made, whether they're responsive or not, perhaps. But I suppose the question is, how do we keep this going? Because is there a danger that it's just going to, once the season starts, it's just going to fall off the face of the earth and people go back to normal again? It doesn't seem like that in terms of the atmosphere, but, you know, we have had things like this before where the Black Lives Matter movement has been at the forefront of certainly the UK tabloids, but then it falls away again. How do we make sure, you know, particularly in motorsport, it stays as an issue that we try and solve? Is that question even answerable?
Well, you can't, once that momentum starts, and the momentum has started, you have to keep the momentum going. Okay, Ross has already stepped up and says, okay, we are going to continue. And let's face it, Formula One is the NFL of auto racing. It is the big league. There's not, NASCAR is not close to Formula One in terms of magnitude, nor is IndyCar. Formula One is on another planet. And they just so happen to have a driver of color that is a world champion, one of the greatest ever to walk the planet, right?
Yeah.
Formula One can and all because of Ron Dennis. Ron Dennis was is the diversity king for Formula One. He groomed Lewis Hamilton. Ron Dennis should be knighted for that. I mean, he should be bowing in front of the queen for that. And so should Lewis. They should be side by side. If I was the queen, I'd march Ron and Lewis and Bernie, all three of them in.
Mm. Well, there is a huge debate every year that Lewis Hamilton hasn't been honored by the queen every year. You know, other sportsmen and athletes get honored, and yet he is always overlooked. And it bring before in years gone by, the question has never been of race has never quite come up properly. It's always something that people have tended to skip over. But I think that is now a question that people ask. You know, is that racism inherent that we are just, you know, he's not being honored because of the color of his skin, yet he is the, you know, he's probably the greatest motorsport driver to ever
in
live.
History.
Ever.
In history.
Yeah. And it does feel like that this time around, because these things come and go, don't they? You know, there'll be something that brings race into the public eye for a while, then it dies, then it comes back. And this one feels like, for in my lifetime anyway, the first time that I've experienced such conversation around it. Like, all my friends are talking about it, everyone on the news is talking about it, and it's the first time I feel like people are sort of looking inside themselves and really thinking about the way they perceive things, and not just going, I'm not racist, it's fine, yeah, what are you talking about? They're actually going deep inside themselves and taking the time to think, actually, hang on a minute, how do I react to race? And that sort of feels like a bit of a sea change to me. And I've never felt it like it is now. And I don't know whether it's the same feeling you're getting over in the States, but certainly over here, that's the feeling I get. People are really searching within themselves this time.
Well, and that's the only way it's going to go. Continue that it's momentum. Okay, people are seeing it now. The whole world is seeing it. We communication has never been bigger and better worldwide than it is now. We all know what to do. It's really not rocket science, and just do it. Okay, there's been inequities over hundreds of years. Okay, let's make the adjustments to those inequities and not be afraid to make a change. Mm. And you've got and the young men your age. I mean, you guys are young.
Well, he's young. Harry's young. Me, not so much.
Well, when you get 65, like Willie T, you'll say it. And it's your turn. It's your turn. It's your generation's turn to run the ball or drive the car. And it's great because there are older generations like, say, Ron Dennis, all right, and like Bernie and like Ross Braun that see it. They know it's got to be done. Right. And they're going to endorse it.
And I think as well, the timing of Uppity, it couldn't have come at a better time almost as well. So hopefully that plus the amount of influential sportsmen, not just Lewis Hamilton, but people across the board in sports as well, and in every other aspect of life, that exactly, as you say, momentum is so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
It feels almost a bit weird then cutting to a different type of subject, but on the subject line of modern day motorsports and things you watch and enjoy and actively listen to, do you know much about Formula E? That's a new championship and all electric. What do you think of this sort of new modern day technology world of racing?
You know, when I first heard about it, I thought it was the name of a vibrator. No, literally. I thought, okay, no, they couldn't be serious. Right?
Can I give, hang on, round of applause.
You know, sound is everything, okay, gentlemen? And I'm going to be really graphic, okay? When Bernie...
We're not talking about the vibrator anymore, are we? We've moved on to motorsport. Right, good.
I got to tell you, I was asked a long time ago, what did I do as a hobby? Well, I shoot. My son, Theo, is one of the top shooters in the world, comes to England every year and shoots with George Digweed, who is the greatest shooter in the planet, and he's from England. And so they asked me, why didn't I like golf? I said, well, it's too quiet. I said, I like anything that makes noise. Mm. It could be a race car. That could be a shotgun. That could be a woman. Okay, it's got to make noise, all right? Okay, that they got to put some sound to that electric car.
Yes, okay. I've been saying this.
Okay, right. Because, you know, people like, and there's been complaints that Formula One cars today are not loud.
Too quiet, yeah. Mm.
Right? So now we're going to get out there with a sewing machine. I know it's clean, and you don't have to worry about your eyes burning or the smell, but it's just we got to do something about the sound.
Yeah, yeah, I'm totally with you.
You know, my wife, she was actually sewing, and she doesn't sew very often, but she was sewing, and I heard it. And I thought, damn, I said, that's Formula E right there. And
I thought, that was a spot on impression.
So I was like, okay, it's just not going to draw a big crowd.
What about, you mentioned your son is one of the top shooters. Was there any interest in getting your kids involved in motorsport?
You know, motorsport has become so difficult for a young man now. Back in the days when I was racing, there was lots of Andretti's. There was lots of Unsers. Even Formula One, you had Villeneuve, and then you had Graham Hill and Damon Hill.
Rosberg.
Damon and I are really good friends, right? You don't see it anymore because the difficulty of bringing them up the ladder and the cost. And, shooting was my hobby, clay shooting. And Theo went out with me as a kid and pushed the buttons. And then as soon as he was big enough to hold a shotgun in his shoulder, he started shooting. And he got, and shooting is like golf. It's very technical, right? Especially pro shooters, right? And he picked it up right away and he made a career out of it. And he's, traveling, getting paid, and he's traveling around the world. And that was the reason I came back to England a few years ago in the first place.
Yeah.
Because he was shooting at E.J. Churchill in the World Championship.
Amazing.
In High Wycombe.
And as you say, to get paid for doing a sport you love and you're good at, that must make all
the
difference.
Dream.
When you see so many young motorsport drivers coming up through the field and they're paying to be there, they're not making a single cent. I think I even saw a news story, although I take it with a bit pinch of salt, but Jean Alesi, he had to sell one of his old Ferrari F1 his son's Formula 2 campaign. And you just think, well, if you think for a start, you're lucky to have a Formula 1 car to sell. But also, second off, the fact that he's having to do that is just, it just shows the system is completely flawed.
Yeah, it's changed. It's changed dramatically.
Mm.
And, we'll see. We'll see with everything that's happened with this pandemic, if there's going to be an adjustment. If there's going to be an adjustment in the sport.
Mm. There already is on the calendar front and more packed races, reverse grids, perhaps in Formula One as well. So I think everything's up for grabs these days.
There's a couple of questions. Well, there's actually three questions that we usually ask our guests at the end of a podcast. This is part of our new series, shining a light on certain individuals in the sport. And we weren't actually going to ask these questions, but Harry, I think we should ask two of them. If you're cool with that. I think we should ask, first of all, what's got you excited at the moment? What are you excited about? What's happening in your life that's got you pumped?
Well, the film is done, Uppity, and a great producer saw it by the name of Brian Koppelman, and he does the show Billions on Showtime. He saw Uppity, and he's doing a pilot right now for a 4-year series, spin-off Uppity.
Wow.
Amazing.
The producer will be Don Cheadle.
Fantastic.
That's exciting.
That's in the works right now.
Very exciting. Wow. That's going to be an, I can't wait to see that when that comes out.
And you know, the doc is straight business. 4 years, 8 episodes a season. You know, it's going to be some salacious stuff in there. I mean, the behind the scenes, the words that were used, what? The things that happened, the parties, James Hunt, for example.
Brilliant.
And James Hunt was one of my heroes. I mean, the cat was just he just had personality. He was dancing on a table in Las Vegas one night. It was a Paul Ankles deal. I think it was when they were doing the Formula One race in Vegas. It might have been 83 or 84. And, no, 82, 81 or 82. I'm dancing, and I see Hunt up on the table. He'd already retired. He was up on the table dancing in the disco in the nightclub. And a guy named Hogan, he ran Marlborough, England, right? John Hogan was his name. They were both on the table dancing. Hogan had his shirt on. So you're going to, the scenes for the show, the series, it's going to be.
So I'm assuming someone's going to be playing you. Do you get a say in who that is?
They're gonna have a list for me.
That's so exciting. Cool. And actually, we had James Hunt's son, Freddie Hunt, on the show a few weeks back, and he is the spitting image.
It's freaky.
Tim accidentally called him James.
I did.
He's just
the same
kind of mannerisms and the way he talks and his outlook on life. It's just incredible.
Very different character, though. Very different character.
I'm assuming the final question is the last one that you want to ask.
Yep.
So, Willie T. Ribs, we ask this to all of our guests. What are you scared of?
I would say not succeeding. You know, I've never been afraid of death. I would definitely in the wrong profession for that, right? So I never worried about that. But not accomplishing goals that I set for me.
A brilliant way to end the show. Willie Tears, we could talk to you for hours. I think your story is incredible. We touched on a few things there, but of course, they're all that and more is all in the documentary Upper Tea, which is on Netflix. You can also buy the DVD and have a search it online. It's everywhere, the Willie Tears story. It is fascinating. Willie, thank you so much for coming on the Motormouth podcast.
We're going to do it again, babe.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile and interact with others, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast. We here at Motormouth are a small, independent team. Since starting this podcast just over a year ago, we're reaching over 15,000 of you across 30 countries around the world. And we want to bring the biggest names in motorsport to you. Find out about their lives and careers and have a chat about whatever is going on in the motorsport world. We are determined to carry on producing these episodes. However, they do come at a cost. From securing guests to equipment and editing software and expanding the podcast and app, that's why we've set up a Patreon page where you can help us to carry on doing what we do. There are 3 levels at which you can contribute, starting from £5 a month to £10 or £20. Each tier allows you slightly different levels of access. Depending on which one you choose, you can enjoy early access to podcast episodes, exclusive member benefits, merchandise, shoutouts, and your chance to feature on one of our shows. Any support you can give us is massively appreciated and will help us grow and continue to bring cool content to race fans all over the world.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.